I'd like to call the meeting of the Senate Finance Committee to order this morning. Senator Roebling is on her way, but we thought we'd get started. Got a couple of, process. We are going to, we're going to hear Senate File 509, Senator Limmer's bill. And what we are going to do is we are going to have the bill explained. Then we are going to look at any amendments that the members want to offer. We're going to have committee discussion, and then we will take limited public testimony at the end of the committee meeting that will be limited, and the testimony will be limited to the finance portion of the bill, so we would like to keep it very focused. So we will go ahead, and Senator Limmer, Senate File 509, if you'd like to go ahead and explain it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate 509, as most of our members know, is the proposal to require a photo identification for the purposes of voting. The bill has four articles and covers, number one, the voter registration, photo identification, and provisional balloting, number two, election administration and improved integrity of the system, three, the allowance of electronic rosters for those cities that voluntarily wish to participate in that system, and then also it addresses, with this new system, recounts. The purpose of the Finance Committee this morning is to understand the funding sources for this proposal. The funding comes in three different sources. The first one is from a special reserve funds from the Department of Transportation. That's to allow for a voter identification card in the event that a citizen does not have a driver's license or an identification card that's been sponsored by the state. There are roughly 144,000 people in the state that it's been estimated that don't have any form of identification at all. And they manage to get through life, but they have chosen to do that, but for the purposes of voting, if they cannot afford one, we will provide them one under this bill. Also, we're using $2.5 million of HAVA funds that have been reserved for the improvement of the election system in the state of Minnesota. This is $2.5 million that I'll point out. We have a difference of opinion with the Secretary of State. They wish to use it for other purposes, and we wish to use it for this purpose. And then, of course, the remaining funding that would be available from this committee today.
Madam Chair. Senator Cohen.
I've got three preliminary fiscal notes in front of me. Is there a combined fiscal note?
Is there a what?
Combined fiscal note on this thing? When I heard this in Senator Perry's committee, we had a single fiscal note.
What
are
we following?
Senator Cohen, our fiscal analyst, Brent Gustafson, can speak to that.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, members, a little bit disjointed. There is not, at this time, a consolidated fiscal note. However, what you have in your packet are three completed sections that are signed off by the individual agencies and by MMB. You have fiscal notes on the fourth engrossment for the Secretary of State and for the legislature. The Department of Public Safety portion of the 4E fiscal note was not complete in time for this hearing. However, the 3A version is the fiscal note done to the 3A version of the bill is in your packet, signed off on by DPS and MMB. It is our understanding that the changes that were made in the state government committee did not affect the DPS portion of the bill, and so we felt reasonably confident that the fiscal note for DPS on the 3A would be what would be portrayed on the fourth engrossment version. As a result, they come from separate files. You've got three different looking fiscal notes. However, the information contained is what we expect will be contained in a final consolidated fiscal note. So I think the elements are complete and signed off on by the departments and by MMB.
Okay, so Madam Chair,
Senator Cohen.
So the combination of fiscal notes that we have, is that the totality of the appropriations for this bill?
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, the appropriations in the bill, there is the legislature's, let's start with the easy one, the legislature's fiscal note is not appropriated, but the legislature indicated it would absorb the cost indicated on the fiscal note. The DPS portion of it is addressed through the transfer in the special revenue accounts, and the Secretary of State's fiscal note is funded, as Senator Limmer was speaking to, the Help America Vote Act funding and the general fund appropriation. And there may be amendments to address the appropriations later, but that's what the appropriations address, the costs that are indicated on the fiscal notes.
Okay, so, Madam Chair, Mr.
Senator Cohen.
Finally, two final questions. So what is the total, as the bill's in front of us right now, what is the total general fund cost?
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, in the bill currently there is $1.5 million general fund appropriation for the biennium. I think it's $750,000 a year in Article 3.
Okay. And Madam Chair,
Senator
finally, I assume this committee is the last committee before the floor. Is that correct?
Senator Cohen, that is correct.
So, Madam Chair, will we have the consolidated fiscal note then before the bill is heard on the floor?
Senator Cohen, I would expect it would be available. Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I would expect so as well. Like I said, I don't believe there were changes to the DPS portion of the fiscal note. You know, if there are changes here today, another fiscal note might be necessary. But to the extent the bill largely reflects what's, as it leaves here, if it reflects what's contained in those fiscal notes, I think it's just a matter of timing before that's completed.
Senator Cohen, we just got some different information that because there's legislative members on the task force, that it would have to be referred to rules. Senator Limmer, do you want to continue?
Well, yes, Madam Chair. As I was saying, I was trying to explain the three different funding sources for this bill. I gave a brief description, I think, just as you were coming in the door, and talked about the four articles of the bill. The first one was on voter registration, photo identification, and provisional balloting. The second one was election administration and improved integrity. Third was electronic rosters and recounts. I can go into all of the details, or we can discuss the funding mechanism of it. I also have counsel from the Elections Committee, the fiscal analyst, that can provide some discussion regarding an amendment that we're now considering.
I'm not sure. I know this bill has been heard in a number of committees already, and I'm not sure how much members want as far as background. We usually like to have some background because we do vote out the whole bill, but we are focusing on the fiscal impacts of it. So I'm not sure if members have some questions about the actual process of how this would work before we move into the strictly fiscal impact.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I'm trying to go through it as quickly as I can and finding a lot of paper to process. But I see references to the electronic roster. And Senator Limmer, I know we've talked about that in years past. Can you tell us, are you providing an electronic roster book for each precinct or multiple books? What are you going to do about precincts that I'm assuming they're internet access books? How are you going to work in precincts that are not not wired for internet, because there are some? And I believe there was a really hefty cost to those, and I think your $2 million wouldn't cut that. So I'm wondering
Madam
what's
Chair,
Senator Limmer.
The original bill as it was presented had considerable costs. It was up in the $62 million estimate. And we've taken a lot of, almost all of that electronic mechanism out of the bill. There is a provision to allow for some municipalities, if they choose, they can go forward with an electronic rostering system if they choose to at their own expense. So we've considerably taken the weight of the financial cost out of this bill. I have Mr. McGrath here,
Madam
who can
Chair.
Explain that.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, so if the municipalities want to participate to use those electronic roster books, it's on their own dime.
That's correct.
So you're dumping that almost $60 million onto the local governments?
Well, we're allowing them to make their own decision. We're not necessarily dumping it on them, but it's their choice if they
but
wish
then,
to do
But then, Madam Chair and Senator
Higgins.
Limmer, that makes an unequal system, one of the things that I think Minnesota has done very well throughout the years, all the years, is that whether you vote in Minneapolis or whether you vote in Senator Ingebretson, where do you live? Alexandria or?
Better Minnesota.
Better Minnesota. There you go. The experience is the same. Making a change so that some have roster books and some do not, I think would violate that system that we have had for all these years where it, you know, your voting experience doesn't change whether you go from precinct to precinct.
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, the quality of the voting experience I don't think is going to be any different than it is now.
How you vote
there,
is would be
there
different.
Will be an assurance, though, that if this bill is passed, that the right people who are identified to vote will vote. And for those who can't afford to have proper identification, we're going to provide that. I think it'll be improving the system of voting in the state of Minnesota and in the state of Indiana, where this bill has been modeled after. They actually had an improvement in the way they vote and the speed that they vote, and also at the amount of attracting even more people to vote. And it became a much more streamlined system. I have Mr. McGrath, who is one of the original sponsors of the bill, who could answer any of your questions as well about details of this.
Mr. McGrath, did you want to address that issue, especially with the we took out the provision that had the large fiscal impact having to do with the electronic rosters and how that might work with the local units of government?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Higgins, the system now will work to give each voter the same verification experience regardless of the system that's used. A paper system has been developed to verify eligibility at the polling place. For small polling places, this is likely to be a good option for them so that the expense of the poll book system doesn't have to be incurred in those localities where it's really not needed. They can perform the same verification of eligibility using a list that's provided by the Secretary of State's office. The computer system will essentially automate that process and make it a little bit faster for maybe the higher volume precincts that choose to use them. So the end result is every voter will be subject to the same standard of verification and have the same requirements for identification.
Are there other questions? Members, Senator Langseth.
Well, it's more of a statement than anything, but you know, they say that this polls 80%. Well, it seems logical. Okay, you should have a driver's license, but what is the result? I had a city official call me from a small town in my district yesterday, and he said, you know, there's many elderly people in my town that have lived in the same place for 50 or 60 years. And he said, what are we going to tell them if they show up in the next election without an ID? We know who you are. We know where you live. We've known you all our lives, but you can't vote. I have a 95-year-old mother who voted last fall. Now, the only reason she's got an ID because my sister, who she stays with, got her an ID. If she had been living alone, she wouldn't have one. So you have to realize what the end result of this thing is going to be. And I think it's going to be very humiliating for people who have voted for 70 years to come to the polls and be told, no, you can't vote. It has nothing to do with fraud or anything. We know where you live. We know where you've lived for 70 years, but you can't vote. And the other problem is with college students, their driver's license is usually from where they came from. Well, okay, they're 100 miles from home, and it's Tuesday, the middle of the week, not the weekend, and many of them who have been voting just won't vote. So I think all you have to look at is who this is disenfranchising to realize why the bill is here. I think this is a very bad idea. I think it's a solution in search of a problem. But I just, I was listening to this guy that was on the phone with me yesterday. It really brought it home. What do we tell these people who we know, and we know where they live, and they voted for 70 years, but you can't vote? And I think this is so anti-Minnesota, it's incredible. But it's going to pass because of the ulterior motive. But I think it's a terrible idea.
Senator Lemon.
Madam Chair and Senator, I'd like to at least respond in a couple of your comments. If in the event that one of the 144,000 people who happen to be elderly do not have a proper identification, if they go forward and in that situation, let's say their name is on a old roster or their address is, they just don't have the voter identification, they can provide a provisional ballot to that individual, and that way that individual could vote. They'd have to verify their identification. There's going to be plenty of advertisement ahead of time, a year and a half from now, to direct the public to know of this new system. It's not going to be a surprise to too many people. In the event of a student, if I can read right from Section 18 of Article 1, if the voter is a student, he or she may use a driver's license or an ID card issued by any United States, state, or territory that does not include the voter's current address, along with a current student fee statement that includes a student's address in that precinct. So that would allow a student to do so, even if they didn't have a Minnesota identification card. But it verifies them as who they are and where they live. So that's already been provided. So, and we go even further. We allow people that live in residential facilities, nursing homes, transitional houses, battered women's shelters, they can also vote, and we're making special provision for them. So I don't think it's going to be as onerous as some people have led you to believe.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
I wasn't quite sure what Madam Chair wanted to do. I was holding my questions until Senator Limmer had finished explaining the bill and going through whatever he wanted to do. But now, with his response, I'm compelled to ask. So if the senior citizen, let me ask about the women's shelters. How do those folks vote?
Senator Limmer.
In a women's shelter, the voter may prove identity and residence by having an administrator or designee of the facility sign an oath before the election judge vouching that he or she personally knows the individual's identity and that the individual is a resident of the precinct.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, I thought one of the problems was the vouching system. So
this
we have an exception. Here we have
this
a vouching
system. This is an exception, Senator Cohen.
Okay. So why is this system any safer, this system of vouching any safer than any other system of vouching?
In this particular,
Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, in this particular area where there is an exception, we recognize the uniqueness of people that live in these shelters or nursing homes, and that we're asking the facilitator or the administrator of that facility to vouch for the individual that lives in that facility.
And
it's a different version than what the House has.
Senator Cohen.
And Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, what happens if the administrator is not available that day?
Well, it wouldn't be just for
Senator
that
Limmer.
Day, Madam Chair. It wouldn't be just for that day. Remember, we're going to have a year and a half of educational outreach from the Secretary of State. We've got plenty of education going forward. There certainly will be candidates that will be encouraging people how to vote, and these administrators will know what their responsibilities will be. It won't be just a wake up on election day and suddenly try to understand a new method. It's going to be an education program as well that's included in the bill.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Cohen.
So, I understand that. But what happens if the administrator's not available that day?
Well, it's the administrator or the designee.
And Madam
Senator
Chair,
Cohen.
What happens if it's, say, as opposed to a large nursing home with a number of staff, what happens if it's a women's shelter with just a couple of staff and at a particular time somebody's not available?
Well, Madam Senator Chair, it would be the administrator or a designee.
But in my hypothetical
Senator
scenario,
Cohen.
You've got a universe of, we'll say, two or three people, and they're not available, as opposed to a large nursing home where you might have a universe of 50, 60, 100 people. What happens in that situation?
Senator Cohen, I think these facilities are pretty much always staffed.
Do we know that?
Well, Madam
Senator
Chair, I'm not sure if I know the question or the answer to that specific question, but I would tend to think that if women are in a battered women's shelter for their own protection, there would be adequate staff in that facility 24/7.
Okay.
Senator Cohen.
How about a homeless shelter?
Well, I would imagine, Senator, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, in the event of a homeless center, there are administrators there all the time, 24/7, and they're put there for the safety of the individual and to account for and provide for the care and the shelter for those individuals seeking it. I think that's the standard course, Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair and
Senator
Limmer.
Cohen.
However, in either of my hypotheticals, the women's shelter or the homeless shelter, that staff is not the voting place is not going to be that particular shelter. It's going to be someplace X number of blocks away. So that means the administrator and or designee has to leave what they're doing during the day to go to the voting. unless an election judge is going to come over to the shelter.
Madam Chair, Sir Cohen, they will be signing an oath, so it'll be a signed statement.
But you do that at the polling station.
And Madam Chair, Senator Limmer,
Senator
is the oath
Cohen.
Notarized? You say an oath.
I don't believe, Senator Cohen, or Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, that it is notarized.
So it's an oath of I, John Johnson, the administrator of this particular shelter, certify that so-and-so lives at the shelter.
In this particular case, Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, it probably is no more of a notarization than what is currently being used under existing law right now. Right now, medical staff at, let's say, a nursing home could vouch for a person voting. We don't require them to sign have a notarized statement, and we're not doing anything different for this area of voter than anywhere else.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Limmer,
that
begs the question, what's the point then?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen, the public expects an election system that is built upon the foundation of integrity, and that the identification of individuals when they vote is not being satisfied by simply going to your precinct and signing a piece of paper that's an election roster without presenting any form of identification of who that individual is. So that's the point.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, the citizens of Minnesota have an election system that is it is run with integrity, and there is no there's no reason for this bill. There is no voter fraud that has ever turned over an election in this state. You know, people keep talking about felons voting. Well, this does nothing to felons voting. There's nothing on your ID that says you're a felon, even if you have an ID, which many don't. But you know, you've done all this work for a bill that is undoing some of the best election law in the country. If you had, if you looked at our system compared with any other state, isn't it Indiana where the Secretary of State is now been charged with voter fraud? I mean, he voted in a wrong precinct, deliberately. So I'm not sure I would hold the state of Indiana up as you know, a state we want to emulate. I have a lot of questions about this bill. I'm trying to figure out why. Where was it? You're moving money out of. I can't stand it when I can't find things. You're transferring money from a vehicle services operating account to the state subsidized voter ID card, section 33 of Article 1. I have questions about that. I have questions why you're moving back the canvassing board from pretty much statewide 3 days after to 2 weeks after. You know, all the verification has been moved back for, you know, from a very short timeline to a very long timeline. What in the world are we doing going to provisional ballots? I mean, the legislature, when HAVA first came in, Senator Limmer, you were on that committee. When we worked through that, we decided that having same-day voter registration and vouching made provisional ballots worthless. They were just unnecessary. And now we're coming back to provisional ballots. You're getting rid of vouching except for people in nursing homes? Do I understand that correctly? That's another thing that, you know, is yet again an answer in search of a problem. This, you know, Senator Langseth talked about his mom being unable to vote at one of our neighborhood picnics last summer. Several of the older women in my neighborhood, born and raised in the same community, lived, you know, within three blocks of where she lives right now her entire life, doesn't have a birth certificate. I have a friend who grew up on a river town off the Mississippi River. And as the Mississippi River tends to do every once in a while, it changes course. His whole town is wiped out. All of his educational paperwork is gone. His birth certificate is gone. All of his family's records are gone. What's he supposed to do if he ever had to start all over again with a driver's or with a birth certificate? I mean, we have significant numbers of people in our state who don't have birth certificates. They don't tend to be people who live in our wealthier communities. They tend to be people who live in our poorer communities. And I'm just wondering why we had to go down this road, because it's going backwards. And I'm embarrassed that the state's even trying to do stuff like this.
Senator Limmer.
Well,
to especially respond to the part about the driver vehicle services transfer.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Higgins, if I can bring your attention to Section 32 and 33 of Article 1, that's a reference that you brought up. The reason why we're going through the Department of Transportation to give direction to the Department of Public Safety is Department of Public Safety is the ones who make our driver's licenses and our ID cards. They're the ones that are the most appropriate department agency that would create a voter identification card, and that funding does come out of and at the direction of the Department of Transportation. That's why we have it routing through there. And since this is an additional responsibility to the Department of Public Safety, and that the photo centers where people can get a photo, just like you can get for your driver's license or an ID card, one can get there at the driver license centers throughout the state of Minnesota, which makes it as easy as possible for citizens to avail themselves of this service at no cost to them.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, what is the vehicle services operating account pay for now?
We might have to have counsel tell you the whole thing.
Okay.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, the Driver and Vehicle Services Division and DPS is operated on fees assessed on driver's license and vehicle transactions, and those are routed into one of two accounts, the Vehicle Services Operating Account or the Driver Services Operating Account. The Vehicle Services Operating Account, there's another provision traveling through the legislature right now that increases the filing fees on vehicle transactions by $1.50, and that would mean an additional $1.9 million to that account per year starting in 2012. And this article is made contingent on that enactment going through, and that additional revenue would be available.
Senator Higgins, you may remember that bill coming through here, and the deputy registrars really wanted the $1.50 increase for the handling fee that they receive. The vehicle services, on the other hand, where most of them come in through the mail, said they really didn't have to have that money now. And so that money that would have gone, that would be raised when we raise $1.50 on the handling fee, would be part of the money that would be the money that could be transferred for this purpose, for giving free identification cards.
Senator Cohen's got a question.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, just a second. So when we heard that previous bill.
Did we know about that?
Yeah. This is a little bit of a bait and switch. So when we heard that bill was really to fund this bill then. I didn't know that. So we're raising fees. Is that what I just heard?
Senator Cohen, at the time, that was not thought of. but after we realized that the vehicle services did not need the money, but the deputy registrars did need the money, we knew there would be a pot of money there that would be potentially available for something else, and we are looking at directing it to this.
Madam Chair, come on. Madam Chair, so in retrospect.
Madam Chair, just a point of order. If we can't keep the gallery quiet, the people here, I think there's a decorum. Whether or not Senator Cohen laughs is irregardless, but in every committee I've sat in, even last year when there was a different majority, they made sure that those in the audience were kept quiet or they asked the sergeant to have them removed. And this is like the third time I've heard this, and I'm not appreciative of that.
Thank you, Senator Perry. That's a very good point of order. And the audience needs to remain quiet during the discussion of the committee.
Well, Madam Chair,
Senator Cohen,
in all seriousness, maybe we should recall. I'm not sure where that bill is. I forget who the author is the bill, the registrar fee. Have we passed it off? With apologies, have we passed it off the floor?
Senator Cohen, we have passed it twice. We passed it as a freestanding bill, and it was also in the transportation bill.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, maybe we need to reexamine that, because what do the registrars have to say if now the fee that they requested, which they thought was for ongoing purposes, now suddenly they'll need to redirect for this purpose?
No. Senator Cohen, the deputy registrars in the communities, the counties and the cities and the ones that are private deputy registrars will all get that fee. You may recall that, and I even voted against the bill because of this originally, that the state office was telling us that they didn't necessarily need the fee. And so there was $1.9 million that was not going to be required by them at this time. And so we knew that money was there. It was in the appropriate office because they're the ones that are going to handle the identification cards. And so we are planning to transfer that money to help fund this bill for the identification cards, which Vehicle Services does handle.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Then what's the provision on page 7 where we're paying the, I assume this is deputy registrars, $5 for each application for a voter ID. Where's that money coming from?
Ms. Boyd.
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, that is included in the appropriation from the state subsidized identification account. If to keep the deputy registrars operate entirely on fees, on filing fees assessed on their transactions, and the driver's license agents, I should say, in the bill, And since we cannot charge a fee for the voter identification card, that appropriation is made from this account and will be transmitted back to the driver's license agents to cover the actual cost of issuing the card. So that's included in the appropriation from the account.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins.
So we're charging a fee for something else that's then being, and you know, there's usually some nexus between a fee and what it pays for. But we're doing the bait and switch, like Senator Cohen said. We're charging a fee over here that's going into an account over here that then's going over here. At the very minimum, it shouldn't be a fee. It should be a statewide tax or something that, at least is transparent so people know what it is. But I don't think that anybody who would be, going to the deputy registrars when they're paying that fee or wherever that fee comes from thinks that it's going to end up being used to pay for these voter ID cards that are so totally unnecessary.
Well, Senator Higgins, when they go to the deputy registrars, that fee will go to the deputy registrars. It's only when they do a mail-in. So I guess they would have a choice. If they don't want a fee to go to an extra $1.50, I mean, it's already $4.50. If they don't want the extra $1.50, which is just to keep this whole thing consistent across the state, that everybody pays that, there'll be a $6 fee when they get their registration for their automobile. But to keep it consistent, we're leaving it $6 for everybody. But at the state level, they're not requiring that money to be used for that. And that's the money that is being transferred into this account. So if somebody really objected, they could go to the deputy registrar, and that money would not then be used for these photo identifications.
But, Madam Chair, no one will object because no one will know. If you're going to charge a fee, there is an expectation by everybody out there that somehow that money goes for something that benefits you, the fee payer. That's the nexus I'm talking about. This has no nexus. This is just, taking money out of this account and putting it over in this account, and nobody in the middle gets to find out about it.
We're telling them right now.
Yeah. How many people are listening out of the 5 million that live here, Madam Chair?
Senator Limmer, would you like to continue? I know you have some amendments.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer for your consideration the A51 amendment.
Can we distribute the amendment, please?
And we'll have counsel explain it.
Not distributed yet.
The people over 80.
I think I have it in mind. I got a while to go.
Senator Perry, would you offer the A51 amendment, and then we'll have counsel explain it. Senator Perry offers the A51 amendment. Mr. Bodden, would you like to explain it? Or wait, Ms. Boyd, maybe.
Okay.
Ms. Boyd?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair and members of the committee, the A51 amendment changes the amounts that will be transferred from the vehicle services operating account to the state subsidized ID account. These are based on revised estimates from the Department of Public Safety, based on some changes that were made in the Transportation Committee. The first change is to the 2012 transfer from $45,000 to $75,000. That still includes the $45,000 cost of programming changes with the vendor of the cards, and it also includes now a $30,000 cost of rulemaking that was that will arise from changes made in the bill that DPS will need to do. The second change is in 2013. It decreases the amendment from $1.37 million to $1.1 million. This is based on revised estimates on how much each card will actually cost to produce. It also, that is $985 per card, and that will be based on 72,000 cards. The assumption is half of the estimated 144,000 people in the state that do not currently have a driver's license or a state ID but are eligible to vote. It also includes costs of the $5 filing fee for driver's license agents and for DVS facilities, and also includes a 50-cent per card fee to check with the Systematic Alien Verification for Entitlements Program for the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to check for citizenship of people applying for the state ID card.
I wanted to announce that we do have a quorum. Are there any questions about the amendment? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Senator Limmer, did you have another one that you would like to offer also?
I believe there is, Madam Chair. I'm going to have counsel explain it. I don't know what number it is right now.
This is the 850 amendment.
All right.
Senator Perry, would you like to offer the 850 amendment?
I would, Madam Chair.
Senator Perry offers the 850 amendment. Ms. Boyd, as soon as members get it, would you like to explain it, please?
Madam Chair, I would actually defer to Mr. Gustafson on this amendment if he's willing.
Madam Chair, members, consistent with the prior amendment, the A50 increases the amount of the general fund appropriation on page 49 to the Secretary of State that covers the costs identified in the fiscal note that is above and beyond what is appropriated from the Help America Vote Act fund. And so the fiscal note identified costs of $4,170,000. There are currently $4 million appropriated in the bill. This would increase that amount to match the fiscal note. And then that is the lines 1.2 and 1.3 of the amendment. Line 1.4 of the amendment addresses the base numbers in 2014 and 15 to be consistent with the cost in the fiscal note.
Senator Berglund.
And this money is coming from the general fund?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the amendment changes the amounts appropriated from the general fund in the bill, yes.
And so could you just repeat how much it is again that we're spending now that we're not in this amendment that we wouldn't be spending otherwise?
It's Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the increase in general fund appropriations in the amendment is $170,000. The bill currently has $1.5 million of general fund appropriations for the biennium.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I ask that question is because obviously we have to cut $1.5 million someplace else then. And part of it probably might even come from the Secretary of State's office themselves. And so I think we just need to be really careful about when we're spending money during a budget deficit.
Senator Berglund, I believe we do have some money left on the bottom line. Mr. Gustafson, would you like to just explain that?
Too short.
Madam Chair, members, the Senate budget in total has, as you know, the combination of the omnibus bills has slightly more than $30 million on the bottom line currently.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Mr. Gustafson, is that based on signed off fiscal notes from the Department of Finance that we have extra money on the bottom line?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund.
Mr. Gustafson.
No, that's a reflection of the tracking spreadsheets of the bills as they pass the Senate.
Well, Madam Chair Berglund. And members, I'd just like to remind everyone that you know, the bills that are in conference committee are about $1.2 billion short. So we really don't have this money to spend. And by voting to pass this amendment and this bill, we are making the job of the conferees that much harder because they have to come up with even more money than they haven't been able to find already.
Senator Limmer, any more comment on the amendment?
Madam Chair, no, we're attempting to create an adequate supply of funds for the purposes of this policy as it goes forward. The A50 amendment is before us, and I think it's rather self-explanatory. We've had a good vetting of it, and you know, the direction of how we spend money is reflected in the membership of the legislature. I believe that it's the membership of the Senate that sees this as one of those areas that is needed to modernize our election system, and at the same time to create the very best integrity and security for our voters. And I believe that this bill will enhance the voting system. I believe it'll improve the turnout.
Madam Chair, are we in the amendment or?
No, we're still in the amendment.
Okay.
And that this amendment is part of the foundation stones that put it together from a financial perspective. And so, Madam Chair, the amendment is before us.
Senator Bergling.
Well, Madam Chair, I don't quarrel with you, Senator Limmer. I understand you have a right to spend money as you see fit based on the priorities. But before we spend it, we should know we have it. And I don't believe we have it yet. And that is also your responsibility to make sure we have it before we spend it.
Any other questions on the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A50 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
No. The noes are.
The amendment does prevail. The
division.
All in favor, signify. Please raise your hand. Opposed. It fails on a tie vote.
Too late, Madam Chair. Vote's been taken.
What was the count?
It was five no and four yes.
Then the amendment
fails.
Let's do it again.
No, Madam Chair.
You add people in as you're trying to figure out what your vote count is.
Madam Chair, the vote has been, the motion was made, the vote was called for. Whether it was on a 5-4 vote or a 5-5 vote, the vote failed. Yeah. Now if you want to reconsider the amendment, you can do so by a motion of somebody on the prevailing side.
Okay. I think that it was 5-4 until people came to the table. So the motion does not prevail. Any other discussion?
Lay the bill on the table.
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Did you want general discussion now, or did you want to have the testimony? I had some other questions for Senator Limmer. But how did you want to proceed?
I think we'll go to testimony. And we have requesting to testify Rachel Smith from Hennepin County.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rachel Smith. I'm the elections manager for Hennepin County. I'm also here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of County Officials, the MACO organization. And basically, I'm just here to talk about some of the local impact, local government costs that we expect to see as a result of this. You know, we've been obviously monitoring very closely the bills and the changes, the amendments. And basically, we've kind of looked at a scope of about four different options that we've been looking at and evaluating in terms of cost. The concern that we have is that all four of them do present a local government cost to us in terms of elections administration. And, you know, we've looked at certainly the poll books with the connectivity within the polling place. We scale that back down a little bit to just maybe having poll books in the polling place. And then we've also looked at, well, what if we just implemented poll books for Election Day registration? And then what if we did just a paper-based system? And all four of those options create costs to local government within the bill as it's being proposed. Primarily, there's one issue with the bill continues to require that we enter all Election Day registrations within a 42-day time frame after Election Day. And as you're all aware, the concern that we have is that the last two major elections, we've had recounts or significant post-election duties. And the concern that I have from Hennepin County is that we're likely to see about 130,000 Election Day registrations in 2012, which means that we would need at least 40 temporary people for about 40 days straight, probably between 10 and 12 hours to do that under our paper-based system. That, to me, is a concern. I don't know that we could meet that time frame, and we would likely see overtime costs, especially if we did see some post-election, significant post-election audits or recounts on top of that. Temporary staff is just a fraction of what we would see because, of course, we have to supervise the 40 people entering the voter registration information into the database. So that is one concern from the county perspective. We certainly remain interested in the electronic poll book option. We think that it's something that we've been looking at for a while. The problem is we have a number of competing interests from the county perspective, including redistricting coming up in 2012, and many of us are looking at a voting system purchase for 2012-2013. Again, we remain interested, but they're simply too expensive for us at this point. We do see that there's increased costs as a result of provisional voting, including each of our polling places are likely to see an increase of at least one full-time election judge in each of their polling places, and that does increase the cost related to our cities and townships and overall in just terms of the cost of administering Election Day. It does. We have some concerns about delaying the canvass and the election results, primarily because of the recounts that we've seen in the last two major election cycles. We also think and see that any voter education, if the voter education isn't as widely received, we expect that we could see increased calls, increased impact on our election judges in the polling place. One other major concern, of course, is that the requirement to convene absentee ballot boards is expensive on a daily basis, primarily when we're in the primary election cycle. We have, it could be a pretty significant impact on some of our smaller jurisdictions, primarily because they would be basically calling in people to come and sit for 5 minutes, convene a board, and then leave. So we have some concerns about that. We see that would result in about 20,000 for election, each election cycle, with, again, the impact harder on some of our smaller jurisdictions. We also want to say that the MACO group does support the use of the HAVA funds for the SVRS system. We see that as a very efficient system that we have been continuing to see improvements and evolve, and certainly improves the communication between state agencies, counties, and cities. In particular, we're interested in the redistricting component and some of the new functionality that could improve the system for military and overseas voting. We do hope that the MACO organizations hope that we can continue to serve as a technical resource as the bill continues to move through, and that we're here as a resource to work with the authors in reducing the local government impact and costs. Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll stand for questions.
Are there questions for Ms. Smith?
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. We also had Greg O'Connor on the list. Good morning, Mr. O'Connor.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg O'Connor, and I have been a small business owner for the last 42 years, and more recently, the Director of Legislative Affairs for the Republican Liberty Caucus. When discussing procedures, I think it's important to remember that the right to vote and the casting and counting of our vote represent the only voice citizens have, the ultimate power, if you will, to select those who will make decisions that will directly impact the direction of our government and the role it will play in our lives and our businesses. What we see being done through this legislation is to take additional, reasonable, common sense steps to make sure our voting system is as foolproof as possible, assuring that each citizen's vote counts and that that vote is only cast by a citizen. Now, I have been a poll challenger in the past, and with the present system of voting, which includes things like no ID, same-day registration, and vouching, and when you consider the incentives to commit fraud, high being that control of governments and governments that spend trillions of dollars locally and nationally, it's astonishing to me that the present system is still in place. It also explains why a majority of Minnesota voters favor photo ID. Protecting the integrity of our vote is one of the highest responsibilities of government. Now, having said that, I'm at the same time sensitive to the suggestion that getting a photo ID may be more difficult for others.
Mr. O'Connor?
Yes.
We would appreciate if you could address mainly the fiscal impact.
I think overall what I'm trying to establish is that what I'm saying here suggests that regardless of what the cost might be, that it's worth the expenditure because of these items. And I'll wind this up very shortly. The solution for the poor, the disabled, and those in nursing homes and others can be provided through our well-established Minnesota Association of Charities and Not-for-Profit Organizations, whose very mission statements offer the services needed here. The League of Women Voters will testify today, and they have an excellent education program. The Minnesota Association of Nursing Homes, VFWs and American Legions, our colleges and universities all can provide this service. Finally, the suggestion that there might be some comparatively small additional cost, in my opinion, is a non-starter as an argument. In conclusion, a couple of reflections from our founding fathers come to mind. James Madison, in his 51st Federalist paper, talked about, quote, if men were angels. But maybe more to the point, Thomas Jefferson told us, quote, in questions of power, let no more be heard of confidence in man, but bind him down from mischief with the chains of the Constitution, end quote. Substitute this bill for the word Constitution, and I think you have it. I strongly encourage unanimous support. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Senator Cohen.
I don't want to mix it up with witnesses, but I can't let this go by. First of all, sir, so the charities are going to take care of all the people who can't vote. Is that correct?
I think through our Association of Charities and other not-for-profit organizations, yes, that would be the network that would go out into the communities to make sure.
And Madam Chair, sir, have you surveyed all the charities relative to, have you surveyed the charities in the state to make sure they can do this and take that into account with the diminishment in their endowments, the layoff of staff that they've had over the these past 2 or 3 years? You're reasonably certain that can take place.
Madam Chair, Senator, I have not surveyed them, but I'm very confident, having worked with nonprofits and charities over my business career, that they would fully embrace their responsibility in making sure all people are educated.
And Senator Cohen.
And
Madam Chair, we'll have a chance for fuller discussion, but I can't let this go by relative to the Founding Fathers. Keep in mind the Founding Fathers made it clear that African Americans, women, and Indians were not allowed to vote. And in fact, relative to the African Americans, that was put in the Constitution, basically, because they weren't people.
Chair, thank you. I believe that included only landed gentry that could vote at that time. So, of course, my mother is landed gentry at 95 years old, but she's a woman. So, in those days that you were talking about, she couldn't have voted even so. But.
Thank you, Mr. O'Connor. Mr. McGrath, we have. You don't. You have something additional to add as far as fiscal impact for the bill?
The charities.
Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan McGrath. I'm the executive director of Minnesota Majority. I did have some prepared testimony, but after listening to what's been going on in the hearing, I think I'll just forgo that. Something that's come up in a couple of hearings in the past on local impact of the proposed voter ID bill. I'm hearing, and Ms. Smith just made reference to this idea that we're going to have to add all these election judges. I believe that this system is actually going to alleviate the burden on local governments by providing them the option to use electronic rosters in the polling place. These will create significant cost savings for the local governments. So they may have some expense up front, but in the long term, it's going to save them money. And the notion that we're going to have to add one election judge per polling place to deal with provisional ballots, to me, just lacks sense. When you look at Wisconsin, which has similar voting laws and a similar population to ours, in the last election cycle, they had something like 300 or 400 provisional ballots cast statewide. So if we need one more election judge for each of 4,000-some precincts, we're talking about, what, 10 election judges per provisional ballot? That just doesn't ring true to me. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you. We also have Senator Higgins.
Ask Mr. McGrath a question.
Mr. McGrath, Senator Higgins has a question.
Sir, are you the head of the organization who has been trying to get a photo ID ordinance change in Minneapolis and, I believe, St. Paul?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, I think you're referring to the Minnesota Voters Alliance. No.
So that's not your organization?
No, different organization.
You haven't been part of that group?
Senator Higgins?
Sorry, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
Senator
Higgins.
You go away
Higgins.
On vacation and you come back and you can't remember.
No, I'm with Minnesota Majority, a separate organization.
Thanks for clarifying.
We also have Max Halperin.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Max Halperin, speaking as a private individual concerned about the electronic roster portion of the bill, Article 3. My relevant background is as a professor of computer science. As I explained to the Local Government and Elections Committee, the particular online form of roster contained in the bill would create a substantial risk of Election Day chaos. Unless there are questions, I will not repeat that explanation. Instead, I will turn to the fiscal consequences of this risk. After I gave the same testimony to the House's State Government Finance Committee, Representative Downey also questioned the wisdom of using the online form of roster, and that committee amended the House's bill to the more conservative offline form of roster. The bill would appropriate money on a field of dreams theory, that if the state builds the system, the local governments will come to it. Recall that the online rosters not only are more expensive, but also riskier. Perhaps there are local election officials who would be eager to subject their elections to risks outside their control and prepared to pay for the privilege. More likely, the state would pay to build the system only to have zero counties opt in. Either way, you lose. Money wasted or money spent creating risk. Like your colleagues in the House, you are stewards to the state. By voting for the A48 amendment, presuming it is offered, you will have the opportunity, like the House, to switch to the less expensive, less risky form of roster. That will prevent the state from spending money creating a system likely to have zero users, or perhaps worse. I welcome your questions, and I thank you for your attention.
Questions for Mr. Halperin? Thank you very much. We also have Sherry Knuth from the League of Women Voters.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sherry Knuth, and I am the Public Policy Coordinator for League of Women Voters, Minnesota. Voting is a constitutional right. It does not compare to a voluntary private commercial transaction like cashing a check or purchasing alcohol. Because voting is a constitutional right, the government bears a heavy burden to prove the necessity of any additional requirements it would place on a voter before he or she casts a ballot. That burden has not been met in the case of photo ID. The only thing that a voter photo ID can prevent is voter impersonation, and there is no evidence of voter impersonation in Minnesota. This bill is completely unnecessary. In the absence of voter impersonation, Minnesota should not impose a photo ID requirement. Such a requirement discriminates against voters who do not have appropriate IDs and would face hurdles, insurmountable in some cases, in obtaining IDs and in getting to election offices to verify provisional ballots. A photo ID requirement would disenfranchise some of the very people who currently must work the hardest of all to vote: the frail elderly, the disabled, the homeless. In addition, imposing a photo ID requirement is costly. New costs should never be incurred to solve a non-existent problem such as this one, but especially when Minnesota faces a $5 billion budget deficit. Both the state and local governments, and thus the taxpayers, must incur costs for providing photo IDs, educating voters and election personnel on the new photo ID requirement, and implementing a provisional ballot system, something that Minnesota has never had. League of Women Voters Minnesota believes that the fiscal note for SF-509 does not quantify all of the costs of implementing a photo ID requirement. Changes have been mandated by the courts in other states to bring photo ID laws into compliance with state and federal constitutions. Based on court cases in other jurisdictions, some additional costs that Minnesota may incur include providing mobile units that are handicapped accessible to travel around the state to issue photo IDs. Such mobile units may be needed particularly in rural areas where citizens would have to travel long distances to driver and vehicle services locations. Keeping DVS offices open longer hours to accommodate people who work and cannot get to a DVS location during daytime hours. Paying the costs of underlying documents such as birth certificates and marriage licenses to allow citizens to obtain voter IDs. And finally, the cost of litigating court challenges to a photo ID law. I just want to comment parenthetically on the comments that were made about Wisconsin and whether there would have to be additional judges at the polling places. And I don't believe that comparing Wisconsin to Minnesota is an apples-to-apples comparison, because Wisconsin does not have a photo ID law, and I think the provisional ballots that are cast in that state are for different reasons. So we really can't approximate the numbers based on that state's experience. The fiscal note for SF-509 has been reduced since the bill was first introduced to make electronic rosters voluntary and to shift some costs to local governments. The League of Women Voters believes that the state should not place yet another unfunded mandate on local governments. Moreover, assurances in the beginning of this session that the bill would streamline voting at the precinct level and provide immediate assurance of a voter's eligibility have disappeared. This is because the authors, in a commendable and apparent effort to reduce the high cost of the bill as originally written, have made electronic rosters voluntary and no longer connected to the statewide voter registration system, something that may have been technically impossible in any event. We are thus left with a bill that merely imposes burdens on voters without improving our election system or solving any problem in our system. In Minnesota, we have an especially proud tradition of fair, open, and clean elections. There is no evidence of voter impersonation in Minnesota, and voter impersonation is the only fraud that a voter ID can prevent. SF-509 would take Minnesota several steps backward by creating unnecessary obstacles for honest citizens to vote. LWV Minnesota urges you to vote against this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We have very brief, a brief amount of time for questions. So, Senator Newman.
I'll withhold my question.
Senator Ingrid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have one or two questions here. From the League of Women Voters actually thinks that it wouldn't be a personal responsibility to have a birth certificate for oneself, and that you think the state of Minnesota should have to pay for that, for identification?
Ms. Knuth.
I'm not basing that on personal opinion or the league's opinion, but litigation in Missouri, when Missouri tried to pass a photo ID law, the court struck it down because they viewed it as a burden for the voter, in effect a poll tax of sorts, for the voter have to get those personal documents for a fee in order to get a photo ID.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Ingebretson touched on my question, so I'm going to ask it, Ms. Knuth. The League of Women Voters talks about voting being a constitutional right. Does the League of Women Voters recognize that there comes with that right a certain amount of personal responsibility to participate in a program that protects the integrity of our voting? Personal responsibility, Ms. Knuth.
Well, we certainly encourage personal responsibility. Sorry, Madam Chair and Senator Newman. We certainly encourage responsibility in voting. We make very strong efforts to provide candidate forums so that voters can educate themselves. We provide voter service guides that let people learn about each candidate and issues that may be on the ballot and vote for them. However, you know, there's some people who are not as privileged in our society as others. And I think those are people who are still entitled to vote regardless of documents they have in their possession or their ability to get transportation to places to get IDs.
Senator Newman.
Madam Chair, Ms. Knuth, my question really wasn't directed towards educating voters on issues of the day. My question really is whether or not the League of Women Voters takes a position as to whether or not the constitutional right to vote carries with it some degree of personal responsibility to protect the integrity of the act of voting while in the voting booth. Not the education, the act of voting. Does your organization believe there is any personal responsibility on the part of the voters when they enter the voting booth?
Ms. Knuth.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, I'm puzzled as to why my answer didn't respond to your question. I mean,
Senator Magnus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a few questions on the fiscal note since we're the Finance Committee. And I'd like to have the Secretary of State's office come up, and if someone's here to explain some of the items in the fiscal note.
Is there someone from the Secretary of State's office here? Senator Magnus, we had an amendment fail before, which was going to give some additional funding to the Secretary of State's office to perform the duties which would be associated with this. Without that amendment, the office would probably have to absorb those costs themselves.
Well, Madam Chair, my question is, as I'm looking through the fiscal note here, I see 9,973 hours of programming work, and how did you come up with that number? And how does that get down to the precinct level or the county level?
Good morning. Hi, good morning. I'm Claire Wilson with the Office of the Secretary of State, and I just want to say my scope is fairly limited with the office, so I might have to refer, you know, say that the office can get back to you with the exact way that those costs were assumed. The programming, the way that the poll books are assumed in this bill would mean that there's certain programming that we would go ahead and have to have in place in order for the precincts to be able to operate it. So as Professor Halpern was testifying, we have to have the infrastructure prepared in order for the precincts to opt in.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm just, you know, wondering about 10,000 hours of programming work, just how that shakes out, and whether we have to do that everywhere. And also the rate, the IT rate of $80 an hour. I see other rates in here of $40 an hour. I don't know if that's what we pay here in St. Paul for our IT work, or what we pay someone in Rock County, for example, for their IT work. Where's the $80 an hour come from, and is that just a number we put out because that's what we're doing here at the state, or how does it shake out if we're doing 10,000 hours statewide?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, these are costs that would be incurred by the IT staff at the state in order to program.
So, Madam Chair, this,
Senator Magnus.
Again, my question would be, is this back, going down to the county level, the precinct level? Where are these IT folks coming from that are putting in 10,000 hours?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, it's my understanding that these are IT folks who would be employed by this at the state level to prepare the programming in order to implement. This programming wouldn't be done by at the precinct level. It would be prepared so that the precincts could opt in.
Ms. Olson, do you think that the state would be contracting for some of the service, or is this an in-house cost of $80 an hour?
Madam Chair, I can't answer that, but I can have our office respond to that.
Madam Chair, if I could get that information, that'd be helpful, because I'm trying to figure this out. I'm all for having state employees, and I know Senator Goodwin is anxious to keep all of those going we can, but
all Minnesota.
But I'm trying to figure this out. So if you could get information, that would help. Also, I notice in here the computer suggestions the Secretary of State's office has, and I wonder if you have any estimates on the computer cost. Do you have an example of what this laptop? Can you give me some examples on what those cost? I mean, is it an HP? Is it a Dell? Is it what do these cost?
Ms. Olson,
Madam Chair, Senator Magnus. Again, I believe in the assumptions, and I'm sorry, I don't have the fiscal note in front of me. But the assumptions made were based on the level of hardware that would be needed to implement the connectivity requirements of the bill.
Thanks. Madam Chair, it's $2,500 per laptop. So I was wondering if they had some examples I could go down to Best Buy and see what they cost, or if anyone did that, or if they just come up with $2,500.
Senator Magnus, I don't know. My son just bought a laptop for $500.
Well, that's what I'm trying to figure out, Madam Chair, because we buy them all the time. In fact, the first one I bought, members, the salesman told me if I bought one, it cut my workload in half, so I bought two of them. And this old boy was lying to me. Just made headaches. So,
are there any
Do you have any models that you could quote me on what this model cost? And
well, Madam Chair, Senator Magnus,
if I buy it in Slayton, Minnesota, what it costs, or if I buy it here, or whatever. Well, if we're going to buy them on wholesale and send them out, I mean, we're going to buy a lot of them the way it looks here. So,
Ms. Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, again, I believe the hardware costs were associated with the level of connectivity required by the electronic poll books. It's also my understanding that, again, now the poll books are optional and would have to be purchased at the local level. But we were assuming so many what the cost of those would be. Well, and I do have Madam Chair, Senator Magnus, I do have an answer for the programming cost. And so that would be a combination of staff and probably some contracting as well in order to get that done.
Senator Magnus.
Well, if you could give me some numbers on that, I'd appreciate that, because, for $80 an hour, I'll come and help you too. But the other one other cost I've got is with these stations, you say $1,493 for peripheral items to make the computer station work that we're putting up all over the state here. And, peripheral items include the cables, card readers, so on. Maybe you could get me the information on that too, because not that I'm a computer geek, but $1,500 for peripheral items sounds kind of steep to me. So I guess I'm just questioning where some of the numbers come up in some of these fiscal notes, Madam Chair. I mean, I could buy a lot of stuff for a lot of computer stuff for $4,300. So I guess I'm just questioning where the I'd like to see the bids and the model and everything else. If you could get that to me, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Magnus.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, can I ask Senator Limmer some questions?
We have to be out of here at 20 after 10, and we
Madam Chair.
Vote. But Senator Limmer, if you would come back. We do have two other people who have signed up to testify as well. Well,
Madam Chair, just a second. I deferred questions in Senator Perry's committee in the assumption that we would have a full opportunity to discuss this bill in this committee, but that apparently is not the case, I take it?
Well, Senator Cohen, we've got the whole committee time to do it, so that's usually considered a full discussion.
Well, okay. Senator Limmer, let me get back to this provisional balloting thing. So what happens if a senior citizen, now you have to go someplace to get the, if you cast a provisional ballot, as I understand it from the bill, then you have to go someplace to the election office or something to get that approved. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair and Senator Cohen.
Okay, and what happens if the senior citizen doesn't have the ability to do it or is ill? Because you have to do it within a 10-day period. Is that correct?
It's a seven-day period.
Seven-day period. And two of those days would be a weekend. Correct?
Is it seven business days?
It's seven calendar days.
Seven calendar days.
Okay, so two of those days are a weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So what happens if the senior citizen doesn't have the ability to get to the election office or is ill? Then that senior citizen's vote's not going to count, will it?
Senator Limmer.
You want me to weigh in on that? Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Mr. McGrath.
Senator Cohen, it would be a rare circumstance that you're talking about. Now, myself.
Madam Chair, Mr. McGrath, no. This would have happened to my mother last year. It would not have been a rare circumstance.
Maybe you're aware, maybe you're not aware, that the political parties offer voter assistance services right now. I know that the Republican Party would get that person down to the auditor's office to get that vote counted or get someone in those kind of circumstances to the polling places if they needed a ride, if they needed help with getting their identification. I assume that the DFL does the same.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. McGrath, I'm glad you can speak for the Republican Party. That puts this bill in perspective. But let's say you live in Sarah Lanxess district as opposed to my district where the distances are somewhat great. What happens if there's not a volunteer from the Republican Party who can do that? What happens if the senior citizen has taken ill and can't get there for reasons of health, no matter how many volunteers are there? Assuming they're not going to go in a Medivan or something to the auditor's office. Will that senior citizen then be disenfranchised? Yes or no?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I'm not certain. You're dealing with hypotheticals, so there's a lot of variables I couldn't say for sure.
Okay, Madam Chair, that's a good point.
Senator
Let's
Cohen.
Deal with hypotheticals.
Senator Cohen, we are supposed to be dealing with fiscal issues.
No, Madam Chair, this is the Finance Committee. And for years, the Finance Committee has allowed an exposition of broader issues when bills have come in front of this committee. Now, if we're changing the rules of the Finance and Tax Committees, let's put in the rules, okay? So, Senator Limmer, let me next ask, what about military votes? Somebody's overseas fighting in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, wherever. What happens to that person?
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, military voters would continue to vote absentee in the same fashion they do now.
But they don't have an ID.
Madam Chair, Senator That's Cohen, I would be very astonished if there was any member of our military that did not have identification.
So what happens, Madam Chair, in that circumstance, if somebody's a first-time voter, somebody's a military, in the military and is a first-time voter, what happens with that person?
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I believe they would just submit their absentee ballot under their current system we use now.
So they don't need a photo ID then?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, they would have to provide some documentation of identification with their absentee ballot application.
And what is that?
Senator Cohen.
And Madam Chair, how is that documentation laid out in the bill? What is that documentation?
Mr. McGrath.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, it would be an identification card number.
Military ID card.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Including a military identification card.
Madam Chair, let me ask the broad question of Senator Limmer. There's been talk about felons voting. Now, felons get driver's licenses. In fact, I think you can use a revoked license as an ID. So, obviously, this bill doesn't deal with felons voting. So, Mr. McGrath talked about my hypotheticals. So, let's deal with hypotheticals. What is the problem? Can you quantify the problem over the last 10, 20, 30 years in Minnesota? Quantify the problem of the number of votes cast that have been illegally cast separate from felons. Can we have a quantification?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I've never sold this bill on the idea of trying to fix a problem of a criminal nature in the state of Minnesota. I've always promoted this to modernize our election system, recognize the technology that's available.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry for interrupting
Senator
Limmer, but because time is limited.
Senator Cohen, you are interrupting him.
He didn't understand my question.
Yes, he did.
No, he didn't. I wasn't talking about criminal matters because I said felons can vote. So my question is a quantification of the problems that have existed in the last 10, 20 years. What's the quantification? That's my question.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, I can simply tell you I'm not aware of the quantification you're seeking. I don't need that to justify this bill. This bill is to modernize our election system, to make sure that we have adequate security and integrity in the system that avails itself of an electronic and technological field and technology that's available to us today, and that we have the technology to do it, and we should go forward to do it. We owe it to the public to bring a system that modernizes our system for voting and that assures the individual security of the identity of everyone that's voting.
But Madam Chair, that's why I ask for a quantification.
Senator Cohen,
what have the problems been with the integrity
Senator
and
Cohen,
the security?
He has answered your question. And we need to move on to our next witnesses. We have Carolyn Jackson with the ACLU who has signed up to testify. And Mike Dean, if he would like to come up at the same time. We're looking for brief comments on the fiscal impact.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, Madam Chair, and the members of the committee. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm the lobbying coordinator with the ACLU of Minnesota, and I'll make my point brief. This raises serious constitutional issues, which will be litigated. A simple motion practice litigation costs about $150,000 to the state. Something of this level in Georgia, I believe that it went back and forth to the courts three or four times before it was settled. In Missouri, the challenge to voter ID was thrown out, and you're looking at a minimum of $2 million in litigation costs, and this bill does not address that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Jackson, Mr. Dean.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota. We're a nonpartisan government watchdog group. And I just want to raise some concerns about the financial impacts of this legislation. Basically, there's three major impacts that I think you are not taking account with the current fiscal impact. First, really, that the legislation underestimates the protections that you must provide to voters. So when the Supreme Court ruled in the Indiana case, I found that the states may be required to alleviate burdens posed by photo ID, and that mainly revolves around public education. I think the current fiscal note significantly underestimates the cost of public education. Common Cause looked at how other states have handled public education around this figured out that it would actually cost Minnesota about $8 million to do a proper job around public education. The second area I want to raise concerns about is the cost of the free ID. I think the estimate there is also significantly low. When you look at when Indiana implemented its voter ID system, it issued 771,000 free voter IDs at a cost of $10 million to the state. Minnesota is only estimating 144,000. So Indiana is a similar size state. I think Minnesota can expect that number to account for here. And I think with this, what's going to happen is you're going to see then an unfunded mandate that's then going to get pushed down to local governments, whether it's the cost of those free IDs, the public education, or in the third area that I want to mention, and that is how you're paying for the bill. By raiding the Help America Vote Act fund, I think you're going to cause significant harm to our election system. Most importantly, by taking money away from the statewide voter registration system, which is really the lifeblood of our election system. I mean, that's really where the integrity is in our election system. If that is not up to date and working properly, our elections will be in complete disarray. And what this bill basically does is it takes away the funding for that program so that it can't be updated in this year. And it's a most critical year because of redistricting happens. There needs to be significant changes to the SVRS system this year. And so what you potentially have, create a system where that SVRS is not getting updated, and people then will not be notified if there's polling location changes. And so that's one of the main goals of the SVRS is this year, is that when those polling location changes, because they do inevitably because of redistricting, then those notifications potentially will not be going out, or the counties themselves are going to have to do that all manually at a significant cost burden to themselves. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Dean. Senator Hand, briefly, please.
Yes, I just wanted to ask the witness, you mentioned he was representing Common Cause. You said that was a nonpartisan organization. What does that mean exactly? In what sense are you nonpartisan?
Common Cause does not endorse any candidates for political office.
Madam Chair, and so it's not the case that you don't take political positions then?
I think almost any issue has a political position to it, so yes.
And, Madam Chair, could you describe the political positions your organization takes? Are they conservative? Are they liberal? Are they left, right, just generally?
I think it depends on the – we tend to take positions on government reform issues, issues around campaign finance, ethics, transparency, also election and integrity issues.
Okay. Senator Perry.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 509 be recommended to pass as amended – and referred, I believe, to rules.
That's the correct motion.
Madam Chair.
Senator Cohen.
On that motion, let me respond to Senator Limmer. Let me offer a somewhat facetious comment, and then if I might, if you'll allow me, a more serious comment.
I could just take the serious comment, maybe.
No, I'd like to offer the facetious comment, too, because I think it relates to what I've been hearing about this bill in this committee and in Senator Perry's committee. I've heard a lot of discussion about – that's why I asked the questions about quantifying the problem. I mean, are there 30 instances of voter fraud? Are there 100 instances? What I hear is that we're concerned about the integrity and how people feel about the election system. Senator Higgins has talked about that basically we're just turning upside down the election system in this state. I'd like to suggest maybe an easier way and a simpler way is maybe if the Secretary of State hire 5 therapists. I don't care if they're at a PhD or a master's level, but we could have some therapists who could counsel people on feeling good about the system. We could go to Senator Langsdas, one of his townships. You could have a group session. I mean, that's the kind of stuff I've been hearing in both committees relative to this bill. And what concerns me relative to that is there has been a history. You've listened to Senator Limmer talk at length about this bill and the need for the bill. Let me just suggest the counter, if you allow me, Madam Chair. There has been a history in this country for the 200-plus years of the expansion of the franchise. As I indicated at the outset, this country did not allow women to vote, did not allow African-Americans to vote, did not allow Indians to vote. As Senator Langsdas suggested, only the landed gentry. This state Senate turns that upside down on its head. This Senate has a woman president, a woman majority leader, a woman chairman of the Finance Committee, and a woman chairman of the Tax Committee. Those folks would not have been allowed to uphold those positions 200 years ago. I'm sorry, and a woman K-12 chairman, absolutely. So arguably, the several top positions in this Senate are held by women. That would not have been the case 200 years ago. The one exception to the continual expansion of the franchise in American history was the period of the latter part of the 19th and the first part, early part of the 20th century. If you read the histories at that time, that was clearly an anti-immigrant time, and the attempt was to prohibit immigrants from voting. But latter-day American history has been significantly different. I'd make the argument that the two most significant events in American history of the 20th century were World War II and the Southern Civil Rights Movement. The Southern Civil Rights Movement was about two things: access to public accommodations and access to the vote. 1964's Mississippi Freedom Summer was all about access to the vote. When Schwerner and Cheney and Goodman were killed by the Klan in June of 1964, they had gone to Longville, to discuss the burning down of the church that had been used as a place to attempt to register votes, our voters. The entirety of Freedom Summer was about the expansion of the franchise. Fannie Lou Hamer did not have a driver's license. She was a sharecropper's daughter. She was a sharecropper herself. When she attempted to vote, was thrown in jail, beaten. She didn't have a photo ID. What she was a citizen of the United States and a citizen of the state of Mississippi. I've had the opportunity. Madam Chair?
This is to the motion?
Yeah, it sure is. Because I think the Southern Civil Rights Movement is the most recent and significant demonstration of the expansion of the franchise. When people were killed for the right to vote, there have been some expansions since then. Obviously, the constitutional amendment to prohibit the poll tax, another means to disenfranchise people. We've had the expansion more recently of the 18-year-old vote. And yet, with this bill, and to the motion of Senator Perry, with a bill that, as best I can tell, is basically a feel-good bill, we're going to feel good about our system. We have not had a single instance brought to the attention of either committee I've been on as to why this bill is necessary. What we have raised are hypotheticals that have not been answered. My senior citizen hypothetical, Senator Langstedt's senior citizen hypothetical, my military hypothetical, those issues have not been answered in this committee or I assume any other committee. So what this bill does is take a move that is contrary to 200 years of American history, and that is to deny the franchise a right, not a privilege, a right to vote.
Thank you, Senator Cohen.
And in conclusion, Madam Chair,
the motion is before us.
I would suggest that this bill has not been proven necessary. As Senator Higgins suggests, turns upside down an election system that has worked well, has not been proven wrong, at least by what we've heard in the committees, and we ought to vote against Senator Perry's motion.
Senator Ingebrigtsen to the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I might just real quickly here make a couple comments. I've been listening to the to what's been going on here, and I find it rather interesting just sitting here taking all this in that this is feel-good legislation. Yeah, you're darn right it is feel-good legislation. Quite frankly, there's 90-some percent of the people in the state of Minnesota are not feeling good about their voting situation right now, and that's why we're here. So let's point that out. With regards to senior citizens, I'm just amazed. I'm just totally astounded about people talking about their parents being disenfranchised and not being helped to get their IDs, quite frankly. I was the first founder of anti-fraud for seniors in the state of Minnesota, and I'm here to tell you that don't underestimate the senior citizens in this state. They're very well together. They have their stuff together. They know what they're doing. And to come into this committee and say that they're going to be somehow disenfranchised by not having the ability to vote because they can't go get an ID, I think you're underestimating probably one of the bigger voting blocks in the state of Minnesota. And I think we're out of line even thinking about that. I should also remind you, when we talk about politics, Senator Cohen made a comment about this being political. And when it comes to felons, I must remind him that in the 1990s, the leader of his own party wanted felons at that time in prison to vote. So when those kinds of things go on in our country, that's why you're going to have 90-some percent of the folks feel like they're being disenfranchised and probably not going to go to the ballots. So, Senator Limmer, thank you very much for bringing this forward. I think it's a great start on something that is going to make Minnesotans feel good about their voting experience, and that's not happening right now. So, thank you.
Senator Perry has moved that Senate File 509 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Rules Committee. All in favor of that motion? Senator Berglund.
I would request a roll call vote, and again, since there were members not present when I mentioned it earlier, the Minnesota Senate has not passed a balanced budget that provides the money to pay for this bill. So we are spending money we don't have if we vote for this bill, and that is one of the reasons I will be voting against it.
Senator Berglund requests a roll call amendment.
And Madam Chair.
The roll will be taken.
Madam Chair.
The roll will be taken.
Senator Berglund.
No.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Hahn?
Yes.
Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Langseth?
No.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Nenow?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Chair